In the Sunday morning class that I teach in the back with the boys, we have been studying the book of Job the past month or so. And as we've been studying that, I come across things that I think, you know, these are some lessons that others need to hear besides us. And these are some wonderful lessons from the book of Job that God has left for us. And I want to maybe for the next few weeks to look at a few of these lessons and see what we can glean from them. And so for a few Sunday nights, we're going to look at the book of Job and see how important these lessons are and how relevant they are. You know, we know so little about Job. You know, the book starts, and if you have your Bibles, as I imagine most of you do, we're mainly going to be looking at Job chapters 1 and 2, parts of them. But it starts out, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And that's pretty much the background we know about Job. You know, we have a long book in the Bible about this man, and yet his background, there's not much there. And it's such a probing, insightful book. One of the examples I gave to the young people that was in, I think it was in one of our books, was about going to the library. And if you know me or if you've known me very long, I love the library. I love bookstores. I can just go and spend hours there. Well, the lesson the example we were talking about was going to the library, going under the biography section. Most libraries have a biography section, and going down and looking at names of various individuals. And coming to one that said, Bobby Stafford. There was my biography. And opening up the pages of it and looking exactly what it said. That might be interesting, but it might be pretty scary too. What's in that biography? But that's what the book of Job pretty much is. It's a biography of Job, but it goes really deep into Job's mind. What Job thought, how Job felt, what went through his mind when all these things were going on. And I just wonder, as we have been looking on Sunday morning at some of these things, what would be going through my mind? And what my biography would say if a story about my life and how I responded to things was in the Bible. Because it is about Job. We know that he lived in the land of Uz, but we don't even know where the land of Uz was. We don't know. There isn't any information inside the Bible or outside the Bible as to where it was. There's been all kinds of guesses, but really we don't know. Obviously it was in the Middle East somewhere, but narrowing it down further than that's almost impossible. But that's where he was from, and that's his background. And we find that, at least it seems like, he lived during the times of the patriarchs, long before the time of the law of Moses, and we'll see tonight one reason why. Now, not everybody believes that, but it seems like that's the consensus as to when he lived. But what's interesting about all of these chapters in Job and what happens to Job is it really doesn't make any difference when he lived, because his lessons, the lessons are timeless. They're just as relevant in the year 2005 AD as they would be in 2005 BC. They're just as relevant, just as applicable, and just as important. So regardless of exactly when he lived or even where he lived, what's important is how Job responded and what was going through Job's mind and how he felt and what he thought. And it is an incredible, incredible book. Obviously, we're not going to look at everything that happens or everything that's said. But tonight, we want to focus on kind of the introduction to Job and what is the beginning of a chain of events that starts, that doesn't end until the end of the book. The book really doesn't take all that long as far as the time period. I'm talking about days and weeks and months that actually happen. Because we know he was lived in this land, and in the very first verse it tells us about Job. It says that he was blameless. Not perfect, but there was no charge that someone could bring against him saying that Job was some sort of evil person. There wasn't anything people could say. This is the same word that's used of qualifications for elders in the New Testament in 1 Timothy 3. He's to be blameless. And in Titus 1. He's to be upright, someone who is morally virtuous, who walks in a way that follows a godly path. That was the kind of person Job was. He feared God. He respected God. He knew the power of God and knew how important it was to follow God and knew the consequences if one didn't. And lastly, he shunned evil. Didn't want anything to do with evil. Didn't want to participate in evil in any way. This was Job. And again, I wonder what my biography would say if it was to be reduced to four short phrases. What would those phrases or words be in my biography? And of course, these are words that are absolutely true. You know, sometimes you'll read a biography and find out later some of the things in it weren't true. Well, we know this is true because it came from God. God knew exactly what Job was like. And of course, that's part of the reason for the book is because God knew Job. And he knew Job was blameless and upright, and that Job feared God, and that he shunned evil. Job doesn't know all these things that's going to happen, though. We find out Job is a fairly wealthy individual. Verse 2, and 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys in a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East. This was someone that was very wealthy, very well respected, and very powerful because of all that he possessed and of who he was. And even though he possessed all these things, he was still blameless and upright. You know, it seems like throughout history, people who were very wealthy didn't handle it well. But Job handled his well. The reason Job handled it well was because he didn't put his trust in them. Because he knew they weren't important. And guess what? God knew that's how Job felt. Well, he was considered the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So you can feature this great family all coming together, all the brothers and sisters, and enjoying each other's company and feasting and so forth. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. What a lesson that is. That's why it seems like this is the days of the patriarchs, because Job seems to be fulfilling the duties of the head of the family, the patriarch. Because here he's offering sacrifices for his family. Now his kids have been having quite a wonderful time, feasting and, you know, being happy and having a good time. Job is more concerned, though, that they're going to be safe and safe eternally. So what does he do? Well, to make sure, because he says, you know, I don't know, maybe they have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. See, without him knowing it. So what does he do? He goes and offers sacrifices for them. And he doesn't just do it once. The text says he does it regularly. Wow, that's quite a tremendous lesson. And fathers today need to go to God regularly on behalf of their children. Regularly. Well, that's not the end of the story. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." This reminds us of 1 Peter 5:8, doesn't it? Where it talks about Satan being a roaring lion, walking about, seeking whom he may devour. So it's very similar to the phrases used in 1 Peter 5. So that's what Satan was doing. Well, then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" It's interesting that Satan, this word for Satan in the Hebrew is sometimes referred to as the accuser. The accuser, you know, that's one of Satan's jobs. See, he's accusing Job. That's what he's getting ready to do. He's accusing Job. And we'll think, well, what's he going to accuse him of? Well, notice what he says. So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land." See, Satan is like pointing his finger at Job. Yeah, you think Job is all wonderful and upright and moral and virtuous, a man of integrity. That's not really Job. Job is only doing those things because you have prospered him with all these children and all these servants and all these possessions. See, Satan, it's like Satan is right there before God, accusing Job. He says, "God, the only reason Job is faithful is because of all these possessions." That's it. See, he's the accuser. And Satan does that. Satan likes to find fault in us. He loves it. He loves when we mess up. He enjoys when we transgress. That's Satan. That's who he is. He likes for us to mess up. So Satan says, "But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." Satan says, "God, you really don't know Job. I know Job, and I know exactly what he's going to do. If you do those things, if you curse him, if you take these things away from him, he will curse you so fast you won't believe it." Satan says, "I know him. You don't know him, God." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now remember, Job has no idea this is going on. Not a clue. This is between God and Satan. And so there's really a battle that's starting. Right here, Job chapter 1, there's a battle. The battleground, unfortunately, is Job. Job is the battleground. And we have two forces diametrically opposed to one another. One pure evil, one pure goodness. And they are fighting over Job's soul. That's what it's about. That is the book of Job. Job is the battleground. And the battle seems to go one way for a while and another way a little later, and then back and forth. And we wonder, who's going to win? And of course, ultimately, it's up to who? It's up to Job as to who wins, just like it is for us. And that's exactly what you and I are. We are a battleground. As long as we're alive, we're a battleground. Satan is pulling us in one direction. God is pulling us in another direction. But it's ultimately up to us as to who wins, Satan or God. Satan is wanting us to mess up. God's not wanting us to. And so the battleground is us. It's our souls. It's our mind. Who will win? Who's going to win that battle? Well, we'll see in the book of Job those type of struggles that Job goes through. How he's back and forth. He's up and down. He seems to have strong faith at one moment and weak faith at another. Well, God says, "Okay, Satan, you can do anything you want. except you cannot touch Job. You can't make him sick. You can't take away his health. You can't kill him. Nothing like that. See, God is the one that was setting limits. First of all, this shows how much more powerful God is than Satan. Satan has powers, obviously, but nothing compared to God. Because Satan knew he had to get God's permission. Satan couldn't do it on his own. He had to get God's permission for this. And so God had set limits. And so, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Well, there's the first thing that happens. This was directly from Satan. Satan's the one that caused this. Well, that's the first thing. Well, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Well, there's a second thing that Satan caused. See how things are being taken away, destroyed. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away. Yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." There's a third thing. Now, Job is being absolutely, you know, this is an onslaught. One right after another, right after another. He has not even had time to mourn or do anything, because one thing comes right after another. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Well, Satan got what he wanted. Now notice, Satan wasn't allowed to touch Job. Nothing happened personally to Job. He wasn't afflicted or hurt or didn't get sick or anything. But everything else in his life, his family, his possessions and servants and so forth, just like that, taken away. Then Job arose, tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in worship. That was his response. Lost his 10 kids, all of his possessions, practically all of his servants, all of these things. And Job's response was, "I need to worship." That's his response. "I need to worship." And he did so. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. He says, in all of this, he didn't. All of it. That's just amazing. No wonder God had said about Job that he was blameless, he was upright, he shunned evil. This was what kind of person Job was, and we see his response. I think the question that comes up, the question that I had asked the young men in the class is, doesn't this tell us why Job served God? All these things were taken away. Job comes back and says, "I was born without anything. I'm going to die without anything. And that's the way it is." And Job said, "That's okay." See, Job trusted God. That's what it was all about. Job trusted God. All of those things were taken away. But he says, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. See, he was going back and looking at all that God had given him. God had given him the 10 children. God had given him all the camels, all the servants, all the possessions. And Job was saying, if I'm going to enjoy God's blessings, then I have to be faithful during the difficult times when all those things are gone. Job says, I can't have it one way and not the other. I have to take the bad with the good. See, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Regardless of which he's doing, whether he's giving or whether he's taking away, Job says, blessed be the name of the Lord. Why do we serve God? That was the question I asked the young men in class. Why do you serve God? And of course, there can be a huge list of answers there. Why do you serve God? Here are some possibilities. Is it out of duty, solely? Do you serve God out of obligation? Do you serve God out of love? Do you serve God out of gratitude? Do you serve God to avoid going to hell? Do you serve God to bring Him glory? See, the list could go on. We can see from Job's account why he served God. But why do we serve God? You know, why did we come this morning to services and worship God? There had to be a reason. Something motivated us to come. What was it? Why are we back tonight? Why will we worship some other time during the week? You know, that's the important question, is why do you serve God? Why do you worship God? What is the motivation behind what you do? There has to be one. What is it? You know, is our faith strong enough, like Job's, to be able to deal with such adversity? Most of us probably will never, ever have that kind of adversity, where all of those things are taken away? Probably not. I mean, we may have some very, very difficult things, but probably nothing like that. God knew exactly what Job could handle and what he couldn't handle. And isn't that what 1 Corinthians 10:13 teaches? God knows exactly what we can handle. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it." I mean, isn't that a divine commentary on the book of Job? God knew exactly what Job could handle. And everybody handles different amounts and different levels and handles them different ways. And God knows exactly what you can handle. And that's a promise, by the way, in 1 Corinthians 10:13. He promises us to never, never allow a temptation that is so great that we cannot handle it. And, of course, handle it through Him. He promises that. I don't know if I could have handled what Job handled here. That may have been more than I could handle, and God would know that. But God was able to see into Job and to know exactly what Job could handle. God knew he could handle having his family wiped out in a matter of minutes. He knew he could handle all of his possessions being gone. He knew he could handle that. And Job's response was, "Thank you, God, for believing in me." See, the first thing he did was worship. Fell down, worshiped God, and said, "I know God gives, but I also know He takes away. And regardless, blessed be the name of God." And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. At least at this point in the book, Job is not charging God with doing anything wrong. Job understands. God believed in Job. God believes in us. Another reason Job was able to handle what happened was Job's faithfulness was not based on his possessions. His faithfulness was not based on the fact that everything was going well in his life. God knew that. And so when it was taken away, Job wasn't destroyed. And I think that's a tremendous lesson for that. We need to make sure that our material possessions and blessings and so forth are not the cause of our faithfulness. And you've probably seen it happen where if someone lost some great possessions or maybe had a large amount of money in the stock market when, you know, a few years ago it just went down the tubes and they lost a lot. Maybe you've known people that pretty much just quit when that happened. Well, that's not the kind of person Job was. Job's faithfulness was not based on his possessions. Let's read a few more verses. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. You get the idea that Satan is just sneaky. You know, every time you see him in the Bible, you know, he's this sneaky, underhanded, deceitful kind of being. And of course, that's exactly what he is. Well, and the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it," just like he said the first time. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." See, there wasn't anything wrong with Job. Job wasn't bringing this upon himself. Again, Job has no idea that Satan and God have been talking. No idea. And God says, "Look, Job is still holding up. He's being faithful. He's a man of integrity." So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." And notice that Satan didn't admit he was wrong. Remember in chapter 1, Satan said, "If you take these possessions away, Job will curse you to your face." Well, he didn't. You don't see Satan coming here and say, "You know, God, you're exactly right. You were sure right back when you said that." No, Satan's not going to admit he's wrong, ever. But he's back to pointing the finger. He's that accuser. Satan is accusing Job. "Yeah, sure you took those things away, but see, you didn't touch him personally. Job is a very selfish person," Satan is saying. "Job only is concerned about himself. You allow me to do something to Job personally, and he will curse you so fast you will not be able to blink. It's going to happen so fast." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life." So Satan could do anything he wanted to Job personally except kill him. Couldn't do that. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Think about the fall of Job. Job was the greatest man of the East, according to chapter 1. The greatest man. Had everything. And now Job barely has anything. He's got to the point, you know, he has no possessions, no money, no anything like that. No children. He has a wife. God did not take away his wife, and it's interesting as to why. He didn't take away his wife. That's not necessarily a good thing, but didn't take away his wife, but everything else is gone. Job is reduced to sitting basically out in the garbage dump with a broken piece of clay pottery scraping off the boils. I mean, how much lower can you go? That's Job. That's where Job finds himself. I mean, from the very top, now he's in the very bottom. And that's Job. So his wife says to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." That was the reason Job kept his wife. God allowed Job to keep his wife. Somebody had to be there to remind Job, "Job, I told you so, you moron. Why didn't you curse God like I told you to? Do you still hold fast to your integrity?" She's saying, "Why, Job? Why? I mean, you have nothing left, Job. It's gone. Just give it up. Okay? Life is not worth living anymore for you. Just ask God to take it away so you can die and it'll be over with. No more painful boils. No more rejections, no more disappointments, nothing more. Let it be over, Job." Well, but he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." amazing. He basically says the same thing he did at the end of chapter 1. Life is not all good. There's bad that comes. Rain comes with sunshine. Okay, there's clouds as well as sunshine. There's valleys as well as peaks. And Job says, how can you say that you can only have good in life, and if bad comes, it's time to curse God? Job says that's what foolish people say. Foolish people that don't understand spiritual things say that. Say that there we should only accept good and never accept anything bad. And in all this, Job did not sin. That's amazing that he didn't. But again, 1 Corinthians 10:13, God knew Job's limit. Job didn't necessarily know Job's limit, but God knew Job's limit. And he knew by doing these things that Job had the ability to withstand all this adversity. He knew Job could do it. And Job does it, and he does it without sinning. What a story. That's why I said this doesn't make any difference where it took place in the world, what time it took place, because it's just as relevant today as it was 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. Satan is still the accuser. God and Satan still have each of us as their battleground individually. Millions of battles going on. Billions of battles going on. We're the battleground. But it's not up to God or up to Satan as to who wins. It's up to us. It's one of those unique situations where the battleground itself decides the winner. It's up to us. God's promised He's never going to take us to the point where it's beyond what we're able to bear. He promises that. Even though almost in everybody's life, they get to a point and says, I don't know how I can handle anymore. If you haven't said it, you probably will. And Job, later on in the book, as we're going to see in the next few weeks, God willing, Job gets to the point where he wonders about certain things. He starts to ask God. He questions God. He wants some answers. But don't you? I've had things happen in my life that I can't imagine what the point was. I guess there was one. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't figure it out. I wasn't supposed to figure it out. And I won't know in this lifetime. Job doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. And we don't either. And that's a tremendous lesson. We just have to remember 1 Corinthians 10:13, that He's never going to push us beyond what we're able to bear. It's an absolute, unconditional, guarantee promise. He won't do it. And we see that in the life of Job. Job tells us what it means to be faithful. Job tells us how important it is to walk upright and be blameless, to shun evil. He's a great example for us, as many are in the Old Testament, but Job is a great one. During difficult times, who do you turn to? You turn to God. You don't understand why things are happening, but God doesn't ask us to understand why things are happening. Job didn't know. Job does question, and it's okay to question. It's okay to wonder why. But God just says, remain faithful, right? Revelation 2:10. Really, Job and the book of Revelation go hand in hand in their lesson. Be faithful, you'll be given the crown of life. You will, and I will, each of us will. There's a battleground, there's a battle. Who's going to win? It's up to you. And every time we meet, we have an opportunity to make those right decisions about who's going to win. Satan going to win, or is God going to win? And if you're of an accountable age that you understand what repentance is, of what it means to turn to God, and you understand what making that great confession is, and you know the purpose and meaning of baptism, then you need to make that decision to be immersed for the forgiveness of your sins. That's a great victory. Also, as we mentioned this morning about allowing sin to stay in our lives, sometimes we need to come forward and confess those sins openly. Most of the time we don't. Sometimes we do. And we have that opportunity. And you have that opportunity tonight. And I would encourage you to think about that battle that's going on, who's winning that battle, and what you can do about it. And if you need to do something about it, I would encourage you to come as we stand and sing this song.